A collection of everything. So big it can never be catalogued or appraised. The loot of the world.
You got 5 seconds to tell me where you buried the loot. Where's the loot?
I don't know who's got the loot. I don't know if anybody's got the loot.
Hello, looters! Welcome to Thief's Monthly Movie Loot, the podcast where I talk about the loot of films I watch every month. My name is Carlo, and that's what we'll be doing today. Before we start today's episode, as usual, thanks to everybody that has been listening to our latest episodes, especially episode 38, The May Loot. My friend Sylvie at Sly_with shared some thoughts since I talked about Howard Hawks' El Dorado and how he had directed two similar films, Rio Bravo and Rio Lobo. Sylvie said, "Love Rio Bravo. I haven't seen the other versions, but the main reason I love it is Angie Dickinson's character, so I'm pretty sure I wouldn't like it as much." She was also happy that I liked Marcel Carnet's Le Jeu s'élève so much, and she also gave me some pointers in French pronunciation, specifically Le Jeu s'élève, when I was saying Le Jeu s'élève. So thanks, Sylvie, let me know how I did this time. Jacob Neff at JJ Starflyer said, "After completing Osu's entire available filmography, Tokyo Story is my overall favorite, though it did have the benefit of being my second viewing. Regardless, it's the most popular for good reason." We then got into a great conversation about Osu, since I've only seen two of his films and he has seen them all, and he shared his ranking and some recommendations. So thanks, Jacob. Keram at K. Maliki Sanchez said, "Another great episode. I'm now a regular fan and listener, and thanks for including my thoughts in the show. Brazil remains one of my all-time fave films." So thanks, Keram, for listening. Also, thanks to the Potato Lady at Bex Goose, who listened and reviewed one of our episodes, special episode 4 on When Harry Met Sally. I'm gonna flex this, so bear with me. She wrote, "I chose this special episode because I love When Harry Met Sally. It didn't surprise me that the people who wrote in about their favorite moments from this movie all brought up Carrie Fisher's performance. She really stole the show. As a former English teacher, I thoroughly appreciated the host's careful analysis of the film. He went far beneath the surface to tease out the meaning of certain moments, the layers of character development, and the symbolism of certain actions. He also made sure to include sound bites from the film, which is helpful for those who haven't seen it. The show is carefully constructed and paced, and it is easily accessible to anyone who likes watching movies. You don't have to be a film buff to enjoy. Just find an episode about a movie you love or love to hate and let him take you on a journey." And she rated us 19 out of 20 looted potatoes, which I loved. So thank you, Bex. Hope you keep listening. Finally, like I said in previous episodes, I had the opportunity to be a guest at Piecing It Together podcast with David Rosen, where we talk about Spiral. That episode is already out, so make sure you check out his Twitter feed at PiecingPod and check what we have to say about this new installment in the Saw franchise and where it draws inspiration. But let's get on with today's episode, which we're calling the Blockbuster Loot. And for this, we have another great guest, Ian from the Best Film Ever podcast. We're going to be talking about blockbusters and box office earners, and as a frame of reference, we'll be using the list of highest grossing films, which can be found on Wikipedia and on any site that talks about box office. To give you all an idea of what is on the list, I'm going to read the top 10 from it. Number 1, Avatar. Number 2, Avengers Endgame. Number 3, Titanic. Number 4, Star Wars The Force Awakens. Number 5, Avengers Infinity War. Number 6, Jurassic World. Number 7, The Lion King, the 2019 live-action remake. Number 8, The Avengers. Number 9, Furious 7. And number 10, Frozen 2. So that should give you an idea of what's on the list and the kind of film we'll be talking about. So let's go.
The Blockbuster Loot.
And welcome, 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 welcome to the podcast that has a guest from the podcast that does, I think, what it says in the tin. It's Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. My name is Carlo.
I guess that makes my name Ian.
Sorry, had to do it,
It's so weird what I hear. Once Ellie covered for me on an episode and did that, it's just so weird to hear your stuff coming from someone else's register. But it made me feel at home. Thank you very much.
I'll give you the number of my lawyer when we finish. So glad to have you here, Ian.
Hey, really, really glad to be here, actually.
We have, like I said, we have here Ian, the main host of the Best Film Ever podcast, along with Liam, Ellie, Georgia, and Ethan. And if you're part of the film Twitter community, whatever that means, then you probably heard about them. Because in little over a year, Best Film Ever has become one of the most popular film podcasts out there. How do you feel about the success of the podcast?
Wow, you made me feel like I've accomplished so much. I don't know. I think maybe because we're inside of it, we don't see that. I'm just kind of obsessed with what are we putting out next and not so much. I mean, we enjoy the numbers. We really, really do. But I think what we're obsessed with, and by say we, I probably mean me. What I'm obsessed with is just making sure that what we put out is consistently good content, whatever that means, whether it's just audio quality or a variety of films or engagement with our audience. And I think that's the thing that's most rewarding is people who, I see podcasts with lots of downloads, but they don't seem to have a lot of engagement with their community. And you wonder how valid is the download versus the listen. We know we in the podcast community, you have a lot of people who try and proposition you for download sort of deals and whatnot. And it seems people who download ours listen to ours. And that's the part which is amazing. Liam and I constantly joke. It's probably Liam's number one catchphrase on the podcast. Maybe is that he thought we'd have three listeners, and so we weren't really thinking we were gonna stake our claim within film Twitter, so to speak. We were just thought we'd do something kind of fun, and it seems to have found a following. And so from that regard, it's exciting, but it's really humbling. It's really, really humbling that people actually make us appointment listening on a weekly basis, or sometimes 2 to 3 times a week basis. And that part, we're just here for the ride and really just loving every second of it.
We'll talk about the podcast a bit in a while, but tell us about yourself, because I know you teach film studies, but tell our looters a bit about yourself.
Yeah, I kind of fell backwards into even teaching film studies. My degree's in history.
Okay.
I'm qualified to teach history and English, and I'm Canadian, but I've British dual citizenship. My father's British born, my mom's Canadian born. I lived for several years in the UK when I was growing up, and so there's no teaching jobs in Canada, but there were some in the UK, so I came on over and kind of got put into a media kind of perspective. And you can teach English, you teach media now as well. Congratulations. Okay. I went, all right. And then from that sort of segued into now you're teaching film, and then now you're not teaching media, you're mainly just doing film. So basically my job is most days I get to go in and talk about movies all day long, which is not a bad way to go ahead and make a living. And then I guess I'm not tired of it, because on my spare time then I turn some microphones on and we talk about films here too. So that part's, I don't know, it's just really, it's a fun way to spend a day, both during the day and in the evening. And so I think also especially when we talk about, I'm sort of segueing into the podcast thing, I probably shouldn't have, but when you had things like the pandemic, I mean, it gave us a chance to still be social and see people who we weren't really planning on. So that's kind of a little bit about me. Yeah.
That segue was perfect, because that was my next question. You know, how did you decide to start this project?
Well, it actually started with my good friend Liam, who's also on the pod. We go see a lot of films together, and we talk a lot about films, and we just sort of sit in this empty theater while the poor kids wanted to clean up. And we'd go, like, one especially that jumps out at me is when we went and saw The Favorite. And we kind of took a moment at the end and went, what did we just watch? And so I was kind of giving him my perspective, and he was giving me his. And for Christmas one year, I gave him a poster, one of those scratch-off posters, the 100 films you have to see before you die. Okay. And he said, can we make a deal? Can we watch all these together? And I was like, yeah, all right. He said, even the ones we've already seen. I said, sure. And so we got about 5 movies in, and I said, we really should have been documenting this. I've been listening to podcasts for ever and ever. And I, on some level, I always kind of wanted and hoped that I could sort of do one. And so I sort of threw it at him and said, we should do a podcast, kind of sheepishly. And he went, yeah, we should. And I just let it sit there for a bit. And then about a month later, I came back and said, you still up for that podcast thing? And he went, yeah, I am. And I went, oh, okay. So then I got on Amazon, ordered, you know, some very rudimentary gear, and we sat around the world's smallest mixer with 2 very poor quality microphones and released our first episode. And from there, it grew to where we basically have, I think, a root group of 5 voices that will appear in some sort of frequency on the pod.
You know, one thing that happened the other day, I think it was when your anniversary episode that you contrasted the recording of your first episode with one of the new ones. And I listened to your first episode a while ago when I started listening to you. I think it was the first one I listened. But the other day, it was weird because, you know, when Spotify, you play one episode and when it finishes, if it's the last one, it kind of goes back to the last one you listen.
Oh, okay.
So I finished one of your latest episodes. I was in the car and suddenly it started one of the older ones. I think it was episode 3 or, and it sounded so different.
Yeah.
The quality of the recording, and it just goes to show how much you have improved, not only technically, but I think that something I've noticed as I've been listening to you all this time, it's you kind of feel people growing a bit in how they talk about films. You kind of see that in all of you, in how you approach and how you measure your takes on film.
Yeah, I think for Liam and Georgia and Ellie, I think at first, because as we go through, I mean, we're all learning. Liam will talk about, you know, what he picks up about films now has elevated itself. But also, I think it's his feeling that he has a right to have an opinion or to have a voice. And so fighting that kind of imposter syndrome that I think can come across. And he was like, you know, who's, you know, what right do I have to sort of have an opinion? I'm like, no, your opinion's 100% yeah. valid. And the insights that people are picking up now, as opposed to what was happening at the start, not in some super nerdy cinephile kind of way, but more so, you know, elevating beyond, oh, I'd really like to watch that film again, as opposed to, well, okay, what are the elements that sort of make this a good film in your eyes, whatever that term means, good film or great film, what are the elements that contribute to that besides I like the story, as generic as that sounds. Whereas for me, I always felt good with that side of it. But I think my imposter syndrome was having the voice for a pause. I mean, that first one, you even hear me kind of clear my throat as I'm really just, it's just a defense mechanism going, I don't really know what I'm doing here. We're going to turn a mic. And Liam and I didn't talk about it on episode 1. I just fired up the mics and kind of just riffed. And over time, we found a rhythm. We found a format. And I guess felt like I was no longer pretending when you sit behind the microphone and you go, okay, this is actually, people seem to be interested legitimately in what we have to say. So let's walk with confidence that obviously something must be registering on some level.
And I think it's what we were just talking right before we started recording. And I think that what people identify with and what people connect with is that all of you offer a distinct perspective and a distinct point of view about films, not necessarily the cinephile or quote-unquote artsy-fartsy approach to movies, but I hate to use this term, but maybe a layman's approach to cinema. And I think that that's what people connect with.
The original idea was, yeah, it was that Liam is just a regular guy who loves movies and I'm the guy who teaches it. So can we come to a consensus and an accord? And as the podcast has grown, I mean, you've got Ethan who joins us on a semi-regular basis, who's going through university currently for media studies. And so he's engaged with these conversations, probably closer to my perspective, a little bit more theoretical at times, a bit more granular, maybe at times. But then, you know, each person's got their own kind of elements that they really cherish. Ellie does seem to favor newer films and just sort of that vision. And, you know, who are we to say that someone's wrong for not enjoying sort of slow-paced classical films? So that's her perspective. And there's someone listening who will go, absolutely, darn right. You know, I'm tired of people who are these, you know, cinephiles or these film elitists kind of telling me what I'm supposed to like. You know, as opposed to Georgia, who, bless her, she can't seem to keep one actor's face straight. She has a case of face blindness, but she does love herself some practical effects. And really, if it's CG, if it's too pretty, she steers away from that a bit and really looks towards and enjoys the practicality of filmmaking besides acting, besides the camera. What are you doing with set? What are you doing with that sort of thing? And then you've got Liam, who is very much trying to be a defender, I think, of classic cinema, who's going, look, and it's that kind of idea. What do you do when you put a 2021 lens on a film from the past? And so I'm sure there's people who are going, I'm really tired of my childhood favorites being kind of attacked because they don't fit in with what seems to be appropriate now. And he's going, but you must consider. And so I think not necessarily the individual, but that conversation that takes place. And I think the fact that we're not afraid to have sort of these conversations about what makes an opinion valid, I think the answer is all of them. Yeah. You know, any opinion's valid as long as you're willing to sit down and articulate it is kind of where we sit at it. I think that's what makes it fun is that people, I think, there are people who probably lean more towards my side and people who lean towards Liam's and George's and Ethan's and Ellie's. And I think kind of finding your place in that crossfire is a large part of those who do listen, why they seem to have attached themselves to us.
And I think that one of the issues that people have is that people look for other people's opinions to either agree or disagree with, black and white. When I think that the best thing about listening to other people's opinions is see another perspective and kind of weigh in, and I'm not trying to change your point of view, and you're not necessarily trying to change my point of view, but I kind of want to weigh in how you feel, how I feel, how we come to a certain field from different points of view. And I think that that's great.
Yeah, I think recently we've had something where we've sort of bumped into people's nostalgia, both around the table and even in the audience. And people get a little prickly, I think, when you take something they loved as a child and you go, well, if we analyze this a little bit, let's consider this, 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 and that. And then when you give a negative opinion on the film, I think it's coming across that we're given a negative opinion on the way you felt as a child watching that movie. And that couldn't be further from the truth. But I think there's also a message here in kind of looking back through a nostalgic lens at times and going, not everything we remember as children is as great maybe as it was. And it's okay to kind of give yourself that distance and go look at it. And I mean, we just recorded something on Friends, and Ethan had a kind of a hot take from my perspective on it. It was the first time in the pod where I kind of thought myself going, hey, no, come on, hang on, it's Friends. You're not allowed to go ahead and give a dissenting opinion on it. How dare you? And I was like, oh, I caught myself during the recording, and I've just finished editing it. And I catch myself going, oh, okay, I think this is my first time kind of being affected by the nostalgia bug and getting a little, not irritated, but just a little defensive on behalf of what I deem to be my sort of formative nostalgic period.
Yeah, I understand. But I think that as long as one approaches with that openness, with that ability to adjust and just listen to what the other person thinks, I think that that's the most important thing. So in just a year, the podcast Best Film Ever has grown to have a bunch of branches and spin-offs, because you have your regular episodes on both podcasts, because you have the Talking to Miggy also, where you dive into a specific film or TV show in the case of the MCU shows you are doing. You have the regular Real Roundtables, where you tackle certain topics or movie stars. You have the See It or Skip It, where you check on a new film. You have the Clear for Takeoff spin-off, where you talk about pilots of popular TV shows. And maybe I missed something, but was all of this part of the plan from the beginning, or has it all come as a result of the popularity of the podcast?
I think it just came as a result of the popularity of the podcast. We kind of felt that Tuesday, which is our release day for Best Film Ever, was kind of our regular sort of drop of a review. But then we thought, something later in the week to sort of a second, and it was only gonna be like a monthly thing. And so the Real Roundtable was the first one. I think there was some documentary on Robin Williams that was coming out. And so I thought, wouldn't it be great to have kind of like a retrospective of Robin Williams? And it went off and we really enjoyed it. We wanted something that we didn't have to sit down and watch a full movie. You could watch a bunch of Robin Williams stuff to get prepared, and some people did. But the idea being that everybody's kind of got their opinion, and we're not doing anything, we're not, you know, breaking the mold here. I mean, you can go on YouTube and find the top 10 performances by actor X here. But to sort of have a conversation and then talk about kind of, you know, is Robin Williams a great actor? Is Robin Williams a bankable movie star? And which one of those things does it matter? Does it not matter? I don't know. And then again, that those nostalgia things, you know, Mrs. Doubtfire, and are you wrong to crap on Mrs. Doubtfire or Hook? And those sort of conversations where you look at someone's entire body of work. And then from there, I don't know, something new came out. We thought we'd do a See It or Skip It. Well, we went and saw Bill and Ted 3. It's what it was. And because movies had just reopened briefly in the UK, they shut down pretty quickly after. But we wanted to go ahead and sort of have a on the ground, we've just seen it, no research, no granular plot summary, but just here's our raw emotions if you're thinking about. And so there was, and just every now and then I sit down and I go, I've got an idea. And so, yeah, I've got another idea, and we're sort of getting ready to launch that in July. We're going to do a mailbag. We haven't done a mailbag before. We're going to try a mailbag episode and see how that kicks off, kind of just like an Ask BFE kind of concept. And it's just, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I mean, am I borrowing some ideas? Like the idea of a round table and a discussion, and so that's kind of been borrowed, or it's an amalgamation of things that I've heard from various things over the years. It's nothing's a direct steal, but it's just kind of going, what conversations are people willing to have? And occasionally we'll drop a full bonus episode on a Friday, but that's a lot of work. To get that ready to go. That being said, we are doing that a week. And like from the day we're recording this, in like 10 days, we're dropping a bonus episode on Mank, only because we were lucky enough to get an interview with one of the stars. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And it shows also how you're all willing to spread your wings a bit and go into other corners and other areas to explore new things. And that's great. One of the things I love about your show, we were just talking about one of those things, which was the way that all of you approach films. But more than that, I also love that you take the time to engage and acknowledge the community. We were talking also about that, the fledgling fandom, so to speak, and give back the love from something simple as a shout out or a retweet. Now you're into merchandise and stickers and t-shirts and all of that is great. But I love how you show your love to the community that's listening to you.
I've tried a bunch of things as far as marketing the podcast and things of that nature. I've seen a lot of things from the follow for follow or download for download or these groups that sort of orchestrate mass sort of, I just want it to feel real. I just wanted to feel that people who were engaging with us, they felt like they had a bit of engagement from us. Whether it's just one question, one response, and they got some of our time versus featuring some information on the pod episode itself. I felt that was kind of important with building personalities within it. And actually, I mean, if you think now about the people who regularly feature on ours, and they get their own little sound bites or their own little moments, and it's all earned. It's all organic. Very little has been, you know, thought of ahead of time or how can I incorporate this? And so, you know, we have our regulars, and we see even on Twitter, our regulars are talking to each other in ways sometimes independent of us. And that's been quite interesting to sort of watch. And within those things, I think they each get their own personalities within the show with their comments and their ideas. I mean, you yourself are definitely one of them, one of the original old school ones, as a matter of fact. But then we got, you know, if I say Dwayne Smith, anybody who's listening who's familiar with the podcast,
Dwayne Smith. Going,
exactly. And so these little sort of ideas, you know, our resident postie, Russell, and
Hey, Mr. Postman,
we could name 20 of these, and it's a chance for the people who are regularly listening, and God bless them, our regular listeners tend to be some of our best marketers as well, who go out and say, I'm listening to this, check this out. And so, you know, we want to go, hey, we do really appreciate that. And I do, as we are growing, I am somewhat sitting here going, at some point, is it going to come to a point where that's not as sustainable as it is? And I really hope we can find a way to make that part still remain, because I think a huge part of the pod is the community who are part of it. And so I don't even remember what the question was. I've spoken around it.
I was just commenting on your love for your community.
That's right.
That was perfect. But I think that as long as you keep a healthy engagement and you keep releasing what you're used to in terms of content, people will still come.
Yeah.
You build it, they will come. So the podcast is called Best Film Ever, and your effort is to find the best film ever, right?
Yes.
So tell us about your metric, the criteria on how you choose what films to review, what to watch.
So generally, I mean, it's a bit of a like a five-headed monster, but generally it's got to meet one of the key metric is it's got to be considered either a critical darling or held up as a favorite by the masses. And so what that means is it's got to reach one of the two following. So either it's got to be IMDb rating of 8.0 or above, or it's got to be Rotten Tomatoes of 85% or above. And those tend to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff, more or less. We make exceptions when films are significantly in the public eye, which usually happen because of things like anniversaries. So when we did Clueless, it was the 25th anniversary of Clueless. It was everywhere for those couple of weeks. And it sort of pulled on people's, I remember Clueless. And so in those cases, we sort of jump on those. The other example might be if you have a big sequel coming out. And so when No Time to Die, the James Bond movie, finally shows up with Daniel Craig's last performance, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Daniel Craig's first performance that week getting a review on Best Film Ever as a way to sort of
you heard it first here.
Here we go. Here's some breaking news for you. I don't even think the people on the pod know this. Like, I hold the film list as an iron held behind like multiple passwords and knock lists and all that stuff. If you want to, so they know very little about what comes up actually. And then once a year, each of the hosts is allowed it's a mix of stuff that I plan and choices that the individuals can bring to the table. But once a year, they get one wild card pick. Anything you want, doesn't have to qualify on any metric. If you want to sit there and say, I believe this is truly one of the best films ever, then bring it to the table. That's fine. But be prepared to have to answer for your choice in the case that it's absolutely terrible. I mean, Georgia picked The Hitman's Bodyguard. And I haven't seen that film. Yeah, I'd never even, when she said the name of it, Georgia's always, I never know the film she's choosing. Like, never. Very rarely have I even heard of it.
She was the one to show some Howl's Moving Castle, right?
She did Howl's Moving Castle, which I'd never heard of. I'll admit my anime isn't very strong. I'd only seen Spirited Away. That was the entirety of my anime sort of understanding. So she came with Howl's Moving Castle. I literally had this look on my face like, you've said words. I've never heard of this. Just like Hitman's Bodyguard. She is one to go off the beaten path a bit. Ellie, you can probably predict it's going to be either something really, really dark, or it may be something musical in some sort of nature, like a Moulin Rouge or something like that. Liam, you can generally predict he's going to go old. And so I think he's the one who picked Rocky. He picked Angels with Dirty Faces. He's sort of let it slip. His next pick is going to be old as well. So that guarantees Ellie's going to hate it. And then, I don't know, I try and fill in the gaps a bit, I suppose. I've got kind of a... Liam and I spoke about this. We're really eager not to give away all of our best super heavyweights. I think this one could challenge, because we don't want to burn through those super, super quick. So, like, we did Dark Knight episode 4, and I went, kind of wish we still had that in the chamber. But when you first start, you have no idea how long you're actually going to do this for. So I think now we're committed. But those are more or less the criteria that a film has to reach. We are making a slight exception with Mank, only because we are getting Sean Persaud to come on and speak of the film. And it was nominated for like 9 Oscars this year. So
10 Oscars.
10 Oscars. So we made an exception on that. Generally, also, if it gets nominated for Best Picture, or if it wins Best Actor, Best Actress, you can qualify through that as well, because it's, you know. So, for instance, that was Theory of Everything qualified underneath that umbrella because it was an exceptional acting performance, so the Academy says, and so we gave it a watch for that.
Okay, so those are your metrics, but, you know, there are other metrics, and studios and producers like to use the metric of box office. And what better way to earn money than with a big blockbuster?
That's right.
And that's what I want to talk today. A blockbuster is defined as a work of entertainment. We're talking about films, but that is highly popular and financially successful, but can also refer to any large budget production intended for quote-unquote blockbuster status, aimed at mass market, sometimes with merchandise tie-ins and whatnot. What do you think about that definition?
I think it's pretty accurate, yeah. I think the blockbuster's kind of a modern invention. You know, they say the birth of the blockbuster in film is Jaws.
Yes.
What they say. The idea of it going, here's something we're going to market more than the other films. We're making this for the sole purpose of making ridiculous amounts of money with a concerted mass marketing plan in order to sort of reach that goal. I think it's an accurate definition.
Yeah, that's actually the next thing I wanted to mention. You know, there were obviously large, big budget productions since films became mainstream, but Steven Spielberg's Jaws is usually regarded as the first blockbuster. You know, it features most of the characteristics that we currently associate with blockbusters. It was released in summer of 1975, specifically in June. It's an adventure, fast-paced, thrilling. It had a budget of $9 million, which seems crazy low now, but it ended up making a little over $100 million domestically on its first run, so it made,
which at that time was ridiculous money.
Yeah, I mean, it's 10 times its budget, so that kind of set the template of what a blockbuster needed to be. And after that, you know, the studio started aiming for that. You know, we got Star Wars, ED, Ghostbusters, Aliens, Terminator, Die Hard, Indiana Jones, Top Gun, Batman, whatever. Yep. What do you think a film needs to be highly popular and financially successful?
Oh, okay. For the most part today, I'd say you need to make sure... There are some exceptions, but for the most part, you need to make sure it's a film that the entire family can access. The highest grossing films in the UK tend to be films that are rated 12s. So it's not so cookie cutter clean that an older audience won't appreciate what's in it, but it's not so violent or gory or profane that you can't bring multiple, because that's a secret, is getting the whole family theoretically out, or having something that has such broad appeal that everybody goes ahead and shows up to it. There are exceptions, of course. I mean, we saw how popular Logan and Joker have been in recent years and the sort of financials that came along with that. Deadpool, I think the idea of the next Deadpool film will be a true 18 here. I think it'll be like obviously an R rating in North America. And so, you know, even things like, was it Raiders or is it Temple of Doom that sort of causes the PG-13 rating to appear? Because you had to find a middle ground between what was previously just PG and R, and it was this giant chasm. And how do you fill that up?
I think it was around that time. I don't remember if it was Raiders, but it was around that time.
Yeah. So I think you need that. I think you need some sort of an adventure kind of appeal for the most part. Although that is, it's changing though, Carlo. but... So sort of an adventure sort of theme where people can get behind the titular character, resonate with them, good triumphing over evil, usually in fantastic sort of circumstances. I'd say setting, but not necessarily. Like Back to the Future, where your fantastic circumstance was the concept of time travel, as opposed to a killer shark, as opposed to an archaeologist saying that belongs in a museum. But these sort of crazy situations where for a moment we get to live these vicarious things that would never happen. This is not the place or the time for your relatable family drama where people sit around and talk at each other for 2 hours. This is something where the spectacle of the summer blockbuster, even if it's Tom Cruise racing NASCARs around a circuit, you know what I mean? You know, it's Top Gun in a NASCAR. Yeah. Things like that are just enjoyable. And we love a Cinderella story. We love the new guy who rises above and becomes great. The underdog who then becomes the world leader. The problem now, Carlo, is the answer is you just find something someone else has already done and you redo it.
Yeah.
Everything now, unfortunately, and the financials of film are just proving this. Everything is a reboot, a rehash, a sequel. We're mashing it up. We're sharing universes. And this is all that's getting made right now because the financials prove that this logic is sound.
Yeah, you're definitely right. I will dive into that just in a while. I just checked and it was indeed Temple of Doom. Yeah, you were right. Hey. Ian is always right.
Hashtag Ian's always right.
But it was the thing, you know, it's a typical adventure film and fun, but you have a man pulling a heart out of some guy. So it kind of pushed the boundary.
I think it's the occult kind of themes because he's grabbing the heart and he's chanting something.
Yes, and the heart is the beating. It's
definitely, I remember back in more innocent days when I got to say that was the worst of the Indiana Jones franchise. And then Crystal Skull came out and I had to give that moniker to something else.
I had them kind of like very close to the other. I'm not a huge fan of Temple of Doom, but well, that's a
me either.
That's another. But we're gonna talk later about our top five blockbusters. But if we say the word blockbuster, what film comes to your mind?
Oh,
give me a couple.
What film? Independence Day. Okay. Independence Day was. I think of films that become cultural events. Jurassic Park. Films that you couldn't escape, they're everywhere. And for the most part, I am naming stuff that's kind of PG rated. Back to the Future, Indiana Jones. It's funny, a lot of mine are 80s and 90s, because I think this is the last vestige, back to my earlier point, where we were creating new ideas and they were the blockbuster. So you might know what Jurassic Park is, but you quickly see the dinosaurs and go, oh, okay, crazy. You see the big spaceship, you see the NASCAR going around, you see Top Gun and the planes. And it was the idea of it, here's a brand new world we haven't gone into before, and now you have access to it. And we just don't do that anymore. So that was me. How about you? What are the ones that jumped to your mind?
Terminator is a big one.
Oh, that's a one or two.
Two is a big blockbuster. I mean,
because I think of two is the cult. I remember two being a cultural event. Yes. The T-shirts. I was like 12.
Yeah.
When that came out, 11 or 12, and the T-shirts. And if you think about it, it's a violent kind of movie. Yeah. But man, we had all the merch.
Yeah.
I'll Be Back was like a cultural expression, riffed and spoofed said in conversation. Yeah.
The Star Wars films, I mean, all of those, every single one. I mean, and you had all the tie-ins, you know, you can get cups in the fast foods, you can get toys, you can get T-shirts and whatnot. All of those films. The same with Jurassic Park.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to break my own rule here and say the first two Spider-Man films, so big.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe because it was the first of the comic book movies to really go that level big. Yeah. They were huge.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. And to go back to something that you mentioned about what it needs to be a blockbuster, you mentioned the thing about age or being accessible to the whole family. That goes to what a lot of studios are struggling. I mean, studios and directors of films that are meant to be R, but the studios push them to be PG-13, at least here in America. You have to make it PG-13 so we can make more money out of it. If it's R, we're not making as much money about that. So it proves what you mentioned. One of the criticisms of the blockbuster mentality is that studios focus too much on these kind of films. You know, they want to make money. They just want to make blockbusters, which leaves little to no space for smaller films, original films, or something that's not based on an existing intellectual property, kind of what you mentioned.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think you're right. Film's such a strange thing in today's day and age where you've got, obviously, there's a business side to it and people who look at each film primarily as a financial profit and loss, but then we combine that with a really artistic art form and we force them to coexist. I teach media studies at a like a pre-university kind of level, and there are these two theorists called Curran and Seton who believe that because as we've gone along, we have a small number of massive conglomerates at the top. And so the way to run your company, if you're one of these massive conglomerates, is to reduce risk so you can maximize profits. And so once you find a formula, you beat that into the ground. So we'll keep seeing Marvel comic book movies until people stop going to see them.
Yeah.
The same thing will be said about reboots and remakes and sequels. Until we finally go, no, thank you, I want to see something else. This is exactly what all the theater space will go into. I remember I went to we have a fairly small cinema near us, up here in England in the area we're from, called King's Lynn. And I remember I walked in once, and it's just like a little 3-4 cinema screen cinema. But I looked around at all the movies they were showing, and there wasn't one piece of original content, like a first go through. Everything was based on either an existing intellectual property or a reboot or a sequel. And I kind of just got sad. And so if you want to see original content now and new stories, you're really forced to go for these smaller, more independent studios and pictures. The problem is, can those people find access to cinema space, or are they destined to be straight to a streaming platform? I have a friend who made a film and ended up, it's like 91% on Rotten Tomatoes, but he ended up going direct to, I think originally it was Netflix, and now I think his distributors are kind of scattered across the globe, but he went streaming first as part of his production company. And that seems to be, I think, where that's headed, which is a shame, because I'd like to see a time and place where independent cinema can still end up on the big screen.
Yeah, actually, you're nailing the next argument I wanted to bring, because on our last episode, on Thief's Monthly Movie Load, latest episode, we were talking about obscure films, so-called hidden gems, films that are not known because they were made either independently or buried by a studio or whatever. And I was commenting with my guest, who was also an independent filmmaker, Tyler Jones, about the reasons. And it all boiled down, and this is on him, he made this point quite well, it all boiled down to the marketability, how some studios determine right off the bat when they see a script or a story and they say, I'm not going to make money with this, so I'm not going to make it. And our argument was about how many of these films have great stories and are worthy of attention and deserve their chance at the bat. Sometimes more attention than the ones that are being made and that are earning money, and yet studios see no profitability. And like you're saying, the financials prove that, because people flock to these big budget sequels and films. And some of these little films don't make as much money. So studio wants to make money. It's a clash between two sides.
It's really weird, because when cinema went digital, when the whole process went digital, theoretically, it should have been the great hand up to the independent filmmaker, because now making a film has never been more affordable. You know, if you want to walk around with a couple of entry-level spec DSLRs, you can make a decent movie that looks fantastic. You can edit it now on your computer. You can find ways to distribute it to potential mainstream distributors, you know, digitally. You don't have to make your own film reels anymore, thanks to broadband internet. And thanks to digital projection systems now in cinemas, all these things should be a chance to sort of help the little guy up. You can market your film on YouTube and on Facebook and Twitter. And yet, somehow, kind of counterintuitively, the giants are getting even more of a market share than they were back in the analog age, which feels like it shouldn't be the case. But if I was an independent cinema owner, of which there aren't many of those left either anymore, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to fill the screens with these big studio releases, because I'd be afraid if I carried the small one that it's no one's going to come see it. The only time you see the small ones get carried is when Oscar season comes around and we decide these are the three independent films we see value in this year. And then Jojo Rabbit ends up on your screen.
You can even make a film with a cell phone.
Yeah, you can.
Steven Soderbergh made one. I don't remember what was the title. I think it was called Unsane or something like that. He made a film with his cell phone. And there was a little film, independent film. It was called Tangerine. I saw a while ago, and it was filmed on an iPhone.
Very highly regarded. I haven't got around to seeing that one yet, but it is on my list.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. But one of the things that I was bouncing off of you when we were settling everything for this episode, I sent you a list I found on Wikipedia about the highest grossing films. And obviously to set some boundaries for the discussion we were having. But one of the things that is interesting about that list, I'm going to share some interesting facts about that, because I made my own spreadsheet and started parsing data about it. It has 50 titles. Almost all of the films on the list were released either in summertime or in Christmas time,
yep,
which is what we typically associate with blockbusters. 46 films are from this millennium, post-2000. Only 3 films are from before, 1990s. That goes back also to the tendency to obviously list box office with money instead of tickets.
Yep.
Obviously, the list is going to skew towards newer films. Only, and this one goes to what you were saying, only one film out of 50 is an original story. The other 49 all belong to some sort of big franchise. The only one that doesn't belong to a franchise is Titanic.
Wow.
Of the 50 films, there are 30 sequels, 4 prequels, 4 remakes, and 12 quote-unquote original, but of those 12, most of them are the first installments of Marvel films, for example,
yeah,
or the first installment of a big franchise. There are 9 MCU films, 8 Disney films, 5 Star Wars, 3 Jurassic Park, 3 Harry Potter, 3 Despicable Me, 2 Fast and the Furious, 2 Lord of the Rings Hobbit, 2 Transformers, and 2 Pirates of the Caribbean. So that kind of gives you an idea of why, like you were saying, this is the direction the studios are looking for. You know, I mean, whenever people ask, what, another Disney live action remake? Or whenever they say, why is it all sequels and prequels? Or, oh man, there's superhero fatigue. There's a reason why the studios keep doing those, and it's money.
Yeah, because we keep wanting to see them. And then you get this circular narrative where, as a result, they keep making these trailers and they put them on all the TV shows you love, and you go, oh, and so the only films you're aware of are these new giant sequels. So when it comes in, those are the ones, and it just keeps feeding itself. I mean, the Pirates of the Caribbean is interesting. It's not even the good one.
Yeah.
The good one's not on the list. It's the it's the sort of, you know, less than ones that are showing up because the first one made the big noise and everyone went and saw 2 and 3.
Yes. And you're going to notice that with almost all of the films on the list, all of the sequels, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King is there, actually a legitimate good blockbuster film, in my opinion, but there's no Fellowship. That's Lord of the Rings is a special case, I may say, but Transformers. I hate Transformers, whatever, but the first one isn't there.
Yeah, the first one,
but it's the one that you like.
I'm not saying it's going to win best film ever, but I'm saying it was a fun enough little popcorn movie, but the ones that suck are on the list, aren't they?
Yeah, because the first one makes all the noise and creates the expectation for the sequel. That's what I wanted to bring. You got the first one. The first one shakes all the grass. And when the sequel comes, everybody wants to see, oh, what comes now? And that's why you have, like I said, 30 sequels, 4 prequels, 4 remakes. So it's I don't know.
Well, the minute anything does anything well, we go, oh, it's a sequel coming out. And it's that inability of studios to resist and leave things alone. Joker, for instance. Great standalone film. Yes, I mean, standalone in the sense that it was really supposed to just be a one-off. Yeah. I mean, obviously based on existing DC intellectual property, but it was the way it was going to be. And we were told it's just going to be one, and then sure enough, it makes all the bank, and you hear Joaquin Phoenix is open to a second one. And we're going, well, there we go.
Not only the money, but it was also a critical darling. So
critical darling as well. I mean, I was speaking with a colleague once. I ran into him at a coffee shop here, and I asked him how his weekend was, and he said, well, it was good. I saw 2 animated films, and I believe one of them was Euro and the Two Strings. I haven't seen it, but it's...
Who won the strings?
There it is. And very conceptually interesting in the way that the animation happened, and he was raving about that. So the other one was Sausage Party, and he kind of... lambasted that. Now, having seen the film, like justifiably so, and he got angry. He went, you know which one they're going to make a sequel of? I said, yeah, it's going to be Sausage Party. and he was, it's this weird thing where it's like the audience is unaware that it's a financial property. And quite simply, you know, you went and saw it. You're part of the problem about why we're going to get a second one, because you went and saw the film.
But one of the things you said, sometimes studios don't even wait to see how the film is going to make. And they greenlight sometimes sequels even when they don't know. I mean, look at that Dark Universe thing.
I was about to say that,
How that crashed to the ground. I'm sure that's going to be studied years after, because you saw all the promotional pictures with all the cast, and it was a mess.
The most recent attempt at King Arthur, and that was supposed to develop a King Arthur universe, and that bombed. It's a copycat industry, but I think you've only got so much room in your head for There's this thing in teaching called cognitive load theory, where your mind can only focus on so much at one time. And just how many shared universes do we want to sign up for? And even the MCU, I think I'm sitting here going, I'm done. Endgame was a nice place to sort of put the full stop and say, we're good, everybody. But of course not. There's still money to be made. And we can go ahead and put, you know, Spider-Man's next. And the treadmill keeps on going.
The thing is that I don't want it to sound like we're trashing on blockbusters too much, because when a blockbuster is well done and well handled and well executed, it's great. I mean, you get this, well, to our point, but most of these blockbusters that we have on this list were born on original ideas that worked and were great. For example, I mentioned Die Hard was a big blockbuster in its time, and it's a great film. What happened with all the sequels? They all sucked. You have you have Jurassic Park, and Jurassic Park is on the list still, because it had that staying power, and it's a great film. But you get all the sequels and they all want to milk that cow. And, you know, instead of going back to original ideas, you know, you can take that filmmaker and tell him, you know, make another great film. Doesn't have to be a sequel, but make another great film like that.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree in the sense that sort of our when you think of the movies you love as a child or as a teenager, I mean, the ones that jump to mind are these blockbuster films, these films that were everywhere. I was waxing nostalgic about Terminator 2 and its place in sort of my, you know, middle school existence. But I remember where I was when I saw Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. That film has stayed with me for 20 some odd years now. There's something about watching the impossible come to life on screen. And so I've got nothing against the notion of a blockbuster. I mean, if Top Gun was made today, they would have had a sequel in development as soon as it had finished.
Yes.
And I guess the beautiful part was that's why I said at the start, all the ones I'm thinking of seem to be 80s and 90s, because it was new sort of ideas and concepts. And maybe we weren't as, some might say predictable, some might say lazy with the way that studios are planning their projects. But
yeah, obviously we're going to share our top five blockbusters in a while. So obviously we're going to prove that we like the idea of a blockbuster well made.
Oh, for sure.
But let's head another way. Let's play a game. Are you in for a game?
I love games. Go ahead.
So I know that you all like songs in Best Film Ever.
So, we do.
So the game is called Blockbuster Quote or Song.
Okay.
And it's pretty easy. I'm going to give you a choice of either a quote or a song from a blockbuster movie. Okay. And whatever you decide, I'm going to say a quote or sing a song from a blockbuster. You have to guess what film it is. Oh. And bonus points if you tell me who says the quote or who sings the song.
Oh, I'm totally excited about this. All right.
I'm going to polish my acting skills and singing skills all here right. A bit. So bear with me. Okay. So go ahead. Quote or song?
Let's start with a song.
Okay, I'm going to start with an easy one.
Okay.
And this one is going to be easy for you twofold. Love can touch us one time and last for a lifetime and never let go till we're gone.
I could not have told you the lyrics to that. That is amazing. At first, I was a little bit scared. I was like, oh, I don't get this. That song haunts me because my sister used to play it on repeat over and over and over again. That is Canada's own Celine Dion doing the love theme from Titanic.
Yes, you got it. I told you it's going to be easy twofold because it's fellow Canadian.
That's right.
Okay, so quote or song?
Let's do quote. We'll sort of bounce back and forth here. This is fun.
Okay, let's do another easy one.
Okay.
Mr. Blank, after careful consideration, I've decided not to endorse your park.
Neither do I. That is Jurassic Park.
Yes, who says it?
Mr. Hammond. That's it, Mr. Hammond.
And who says
it? It was said by, it's said by Sam Neill's character. Yes.
Okay, there you go, Alan Grant. Dr. Alan Grant.
Thank you.
Okay, song or quote?
Let's do song again.
Okay, you're going to make me sing again. Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna be a mighty king, so enemies beware.
Well, I've never seen a king of beasts with quite so little hair. It is, I just can't wait to be king from 1994's animated The Lion King.
Yes, okay, you're great, you're doing great. Song or quote?
A quote, let's go ahead.
Okay, this is two people talking.
Okay.
If we can do this, you know, go back in time, why don't we just find baby blank, you know, and... Okay, first of all, that's horrible. It's blank.
Oh, I know I've heard this. Oh, it's obviously a time travel. Is this the conversation they have about how time travel works in Avengers Endgame?
Yes, you got it.
Hey, there we are.
Yeah, you have Rhodey is talking with Hulk, and you know, wow, if we can go back, why don't we kill Thanos? Why don't we kill baby Thanos? And they say, you know, that's how, you know, kind of like playing on the
baby Hitler.
Yeah, baby Hitler thing.
Okay. Yeah, I was waiting for him to go, that's not how time travel works. I was like, if I hear that, I know I'm good for Avengers Endgame. But yes, well done. Okay,
song or quote?
Oh, song, absolutely.
Okay. This is the end. Hold your breath and count to 10. Feel the earth move and then hear my heart burst again. For this is the end.
And this is also Skyfall. Adele doing Skyfall. I live in the UK. That song was everywhere that summer. Everywhere.
Song or quote?
Quote.
Okay, I love this one.
Okay.
You know the thing about Blank? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you.
Ooh, you've got me on this one. I don't know this.
Come on. That's Quint in Joss. Where's
Jaws? It's been so long since I've seen Jaws.
Really?
I really used to give Jaws a bit of a hard time. I think my parents let me see it when I was too young. It kind of traumatized me and I've stayed away. So I am aware it is one we're going to have to go back and review on the pod, but I haven't seen that since I was like 7.
Oh, I look forward to
I think
you doing
I should
that
go, one. Oh, it's a bad movie. It's a bad movie. No, I've seen and studied and taught elements from that film. I'm well aware it's an excellent film. I just need to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, I look forward.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
I could have gone with that one, but that would
Nah, you're fine. Easy. Yours was good.
Okay, so song or quote?
Oh, I miss hearing those dulcet tones. We need some more singing, I think.
Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Shehrazi had 1,000 tails. Well, Master, you in luck, cause up your sleeve. You got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch. Besides, Yahoo and how, and all you gotta do is rub that
lamp, and I'll say, Mr. Aladdin, sir, what will your pleasure be? Take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. Yes. Sang by the incomparable Robin Williams.
Yes.
Or Will Smith, if you're so inclined.
Yes. Okay, a song or quote?
I need to redeem myself on the quote, or just prove I don't know nearly as much as I claim I do.
I'm going to throw you one tailored for you.
Oh, wow, okay.
You truly are incorruptible, aren't you? You won't kill me out of some misplaced sense of self-righteousness, and I won't kill you because you're just too much fun.
I think you and I are destined to do this forever. This is the Dark Knight. The line is obviously the Joker, as played by Heath Ledger. God bless you.
Great, great performance. Song or quote?
Whew, if you've got songs left, I'll go ahead and take another song.
Okay. Watching every motion in my foolish lover's game. Boom, boom. On this endless ocean, finally lovers know no shame. Bum, bum. Turning and returning to some secret place inside. You can chime in whenever you want.
Okay. I remember this more so for, we had some guy come in from Nike basketball to my, I don't know if it was my middle school, I think it was, and show us like clips of Michael Jordan dunking a basketball in slow motion to this. But I believe this is from Top Gun.
Yes.
And I don't know who sings this. I know I should, but I don't know it.
Yeah, it's a one-hit wonder. I mean, at least here. It's called Berlin. It's a singer called Berlin.
Berlin, that's it. Yeah, it's one of the things you only know from that song. And if you don't remember it, then there's nothing else to fall back on.
Okay, so last one. It's going to be a quote.
Okay,
last one. I don't know if you're going to know this one. Let's see. I live my life a quarter mile at a time. You do too. That's why we're brothers. No matter where you are, whether it's a quarter mile away or halfway across the world, you'll always be family.
How dare you? This is Point Break in Cars. I'm Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, you said it.
I almost said Gone in 60 Seconds, a film I've never seen. So I don't know why I was going there. But not Quarter Mile at a Time. I've seen the first one. I made it through the second one. And then I tried the fourth one and gave up on the series.
Oh, you missed
the fourth one is bad.
You're missing the good ones.
I know. I thought I had to get through four so I could then get to the ones with The Rock. And I Fast Four or Fast and Furious Four, whatever they've called it, is some of the worst filmmaking on a major Hollywood production I've ever seen.
I'm not a car guy. I'm not that much into the car culture. But I saw the first one when it came out because, you know, everybody was talking about it. I didn't like it. So I didn't bother with the second one.
Oh, okay.
I didn't bother with the third one. One day, I remember that I think it was shortly after the fifth one came. I caught the fourth one on TV, so I kind of like saw it with no expectations. I was kind of bored and just saw it, and it was okay, slightly better than the first one. But then I saw the fifth one, and the fifth one is really good. The fifth one is really, really good.
Okay.
It was filmed here in Puerto Rico, so I also had that kind of like to bounce off. But it's really good. It's a pretty good action film, and I think that once you adjust yourself to the absurdity of what yes. has become of that franchise, I think you can have fun. I mean, 6 was okay, 7 is pretty good too, and 8 is so crazy bonkers. I think I had fun just because of how stupidly absurd it is.
Yeah, I don't mind having fun in the movie. It doesn't have to necessarily hold up to a logical thing. They say Hobbs and Shaw. I was looking, for some reason, I looked up the Fast and the Furious franchise on Rotten Tomatoes and was just going, tomato meter, kind of where does it sit? And then the Hobbs and Shaw side mix. What am I looking for here? Spinoff, that's the word. Yes. I'm looking for. Is the highest rated. It's like 90-something percent or something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Really?
They say it's that good. High 80s, low 90s, somewhere in that range. Because I was actually sitting there going, this one could qualify. That's insane. I never thought I'd be looking at something that would qualify on its own merit. But I think when number 9 comes out, I may have to dust off number 1. Liam will love it. I know that much.
I would seriously recommend the fifth one. I think okay. the fifth one is a legitimately good action film. With all the things you might expect of a big blockbuster, like we were mentioning. Yeah. But I think it's a legitimately good film.
Excellent.
Okay, so that's it. You did good. You did great. I think you only missed one. So
missed the one.
Yes. Yeah. So as I usually do for my guest episodes, both of us are going to share our loot of blockbusters, our top 5 favorite blockbuster films. From that list we mentioned on Wikipedia, we're going to use that to set some boundaries on what we're going to choose. So let's hear it for your number 5.
My number 5. I went close to home here. You sang the theme song to it just moments ago. I love me some James Bond. And for everything that I just crapped on about blockbuster films, when a Bond film is done right, it is so gratifying. There are certain things. I actually get to teach this film, actually. It's actually on the syllabus. I'm instructed I have to teach Skyfall, which just works. And Bond's a hard play. We do talk about is Bond. What do you do with Bond in 2020, 2021? What do you do with his womanizing ways? And really interested to see how Phoebe Waller-Bridge puts her stamp as a writer on the new Bond film. But for what it is, and for Bond kind of at a crossroads, is he an old dinosaur or are the classics the best? Skyfall is just a fantastic film within a very formulaic kind of concept, which Bond films are. So that's my 5.
Okay, that's great. I'm not a huge fan of that one. I love Casino Royale.
Oh, as a poker player, Casino Royale offends me because he shouldn't have been in that hand.
I know
half of them should have folded preflop.
I know shit about poker, so know nothing about it. But I kind of like it. But Skyfall, it's a good film. It's not a bad film. But I have some issues with how the narrative turns, especially in the last act. But it's a good film. So my 5th one, I'm going to start with one that might seem a bit from left field, but as far as I'm concerned, it's deserving. But here's my reasoning. There was a period of time where, for numerous reasons, I stopped going to the theaters. It was around 2010. I just didn't want to deal with audiences and, you know, talkers and cell phone people. I think the last film I saw during that time was Inception or The Wolfman. But anyway, I didn't go for 5 years until the new Star Wars films came out. And at that point, I said, you know, I have to experience this in a theater. And I went and saw The Force Awakens and had a blast, great experience. Even though the film had some issues, but it's a great film. I like it a lot. But that's not the one. When they released Rogue One the next year, I had the same mentality. I got to see this. And I was a bit wary to the premise. But then it started and I was immediately captivated by this story about outcast rejects that were simply not wanted by society and still were willing to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. And I was hooked. I was blown away by that film right there. I've seen it several times since, and I love it every time more. It's my number three Star Wars film. Not only do I think it's a great story, a story of hope in the midst of bleakness, but also the way they integrated into the original trilogy with that final scene. I gobbled that scene like a hungry baby. I love it. I think it's a great film.
Liam and I went and saw that midnight.
Wow, opening night?
Midnight opening weekends. We didn't want anything to be spoiled for us. And so I think I've determined, we've seen a few films at midnights now. I think my age is starting to catch up with me. And I think my enjoyment of films that I see at midnight isn't as strong for the most part as... Yeah, Rogue One didn't hit for me. I don't know what it was. Maybe I'm too casual of a Star Wars fan, and you've got to have lightsabers for me to jump in. If it's not lightsabers, I'm not. I do really like The Mandalorian, but that's a different form of storytelling where sort of digest for a week. So, yeah. But Rogue One, I had to go back while you were talking. I'm like, that wasn't on the list. No, totally on the list. I did not realize it made that much bank. Wow.
Yeah. And I think it had to do with that expectation. I mean, Force Awakens did pretty well. It was a solid story. And when
I
like
Force Awakens for what
I like it too. Yeah. I think it's pretty good.
I thought you were going Last Jedi on me, but who knows? Maybe that's later in the list, but yes.
it was my honorary mention because Rogue One is my third. Number three Star Wars film, Last Jedi is my fourth. I love it. I know it's divisive, you know, but they lost me with Rise of Skywalker. I hated that one. But let's not get into that. That's a whole other story.
Sounds good.
So let's go with your fourth.
The rest of mine are all sort of turned into cultural events and films. I may be a little unfair in that I'm trying to skew mine towards ones I saw in the cinema because I think there's something about that experience, that corporate viewing experience. That's what blockbusters are, the things that say you have to see this on the big screen. And I remember traipsing down to Orangeville, Ontario, Canada, in the middle of winter. It was a frigid January night as I prepared to get myself ready for 3 hours plus of a love story about a boat sinking, and was kind of... because it was everywhere. You couldn't escape this film. I mean, this film was in the top spot or over top three spots in the North American box office for months. And so I went and saw Titanic and was all in. I was really surprised with the emotional journey it took me on. The fact that, given the nature of the narrative, you really can't have it go to sequelitis and you can't dilute the legacy of it. Such an ambitious piece of filmmaking, the scope. If you can get over James Cameron at the Oscars declaring himself king of the world, you can go. It is a magnificent film. And if it was just about a boat sinking, it wouldn't have been enough. And if it was just about a love story, it wouldn't have been enough. But by sort of interweaving, so the boat sinking is really just a glorified setting for this thing you want to say. And it's Leo at his most Leo-ness as far as looks anyway. You know, a couple years removed from Romeo and Juliet, and he was the, every girl had the magazines with Leo on the front cover. Yeah. I said about my sister and her audio cassette of the three different versions of Celine Dion's song playing on a loop. But despite this, it was a cultural event. The whole 97-98 was Titanic fever. And I even remember having, when the VHSs dropped into, because it was a big fat doubled VHS, when it dropped in shops, that was an event. So, I mean, for about a calendar year, it was the biggest thing in entertainment. And so I'm going to give my vote to Titanic.
That's a great one. And for my fourth one, I took a similar approach to you in that I decided, you know, I kind of shitted with this one. Because it's not that it's a blockbuster. It is definitely a blockbuster, but it's not on the list. So I kind of cheated on this one. But as I was making the list, I noticed that most of them were things I saw in theaters. And I went with your premise. And, you know, I want to choose films that I saw in theaters that were a big experience. And I went with Terminator 2. I think it obviously definitely classifies. Yeah. It's not on the list, obviously, but it's definitely a blockbuster if you ever ask for one. I saw this film in theaters back in the day with my family. I was 15, I think. And it was such a thrilling experience to see that on the big screen. From the truck chasing the motorcycle, from Arnold beating people up, the group ambush at Cyberdyne, the final chase, Arnold and the T-1000 beating the shit of each other, Linda Hamilton buff up and ready to kick ass. I mean, it was something else. I love the film. I have some minor issues with some story choices now that I'm older, maybe. But it's one of the greatest theater experiences experiences I've ever had, and it's definitely one of the best action films out there.
I'm exposed myself as not being the greatest Terminator 2 knowledge base in the world, but the evil cop who's chasing him the whole time, Robert Patrick's character,
yeah,
like a horror movie villain in the sense of taking a horror movie villain and putting him into a science fiction film,
yes,
and just going, what do you have to do to beat this guy? And down to the themes of self-sacrifice. And I'll say what, I mean, if you're not tearing up ever so slightly as you watch the young lad having to watch his hero, his best friend, his father figure drop into the lava, and then with the thumbs up coming out of the lava, it's certain bits of it. I mean, the kids' dialogue is, it couldn't be any more 1991. I mean, it is just a bunch of like catchphrases. It's almost like watching Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen on Full House, some of his things. I'm just like, it's the sound bites. But despite all this, it's just an exciting film with a premise. You kind of understand the premise very, very quickly, which is saying something for a convoluted sort of from the future here to protect you, even though I look at the guy who was, and just the best pivot ever, where you go, what if you took the bad guy from the first film and make him the hero in the second film?
You know, that's one of the things that I've always hated, not about the film, but about the marketing, because they blew that. They had the chance to leave that as a big twist and a big revelation, but trailers blew that chance, you know, because when you see the film and you see how things start unfolding through the first act, it's not clear who the bad guy and who the good guy is. And they play it to that way. The way that the cop behaves, the other Terminator, the way that Arnold, you know, you're coming with the preconceived notion that Arnold might be the bad guy. And I don't understand why the marketing blew that, because that would have been, I mean, like I said, I saw it in theaters back in the day. There was no internet and everybody knew that Arnold was the good guy.
It's a great point. What would it be like if I was watching the kid freak out about seeing the Terminator and his mom freak out, and then realizing, no, hang on, and then we're alongside them rather than us having this knowledge? If we're alongside and then the reveal of, oh my God, he's the hero? That could have been a cool moment. Yeah, fair point.
But another thing I wanted to mention is, to what we were discussing during the episode, you know, it's a sequel. And if you look at the narrative beats of the film, it's pretty much a remake of the first one in most of the way that the plot unfolds. And yet it's so well done and so well executed. You know, James Cameron goes bigger with everything, but he does it so well, and he handles the action sequences so well, and those dramatic moments that, you know, he's pulling your strings and, you know, he's doing his thing, but he does it so well that it definitely works. I love it.
Yeah. Would have thought back-to-back James Cameron entries there from two very different perspectives.
So who goes now?
I guess it's me for number three.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to stay in the 90s. Couldn't get any more different, as I'm going to talk about the high point of the Disney Renaissance, something they still have never beaten to this day, The Lion King. I totally slept on this when it was coming out. You'd get those VHS tapes and it would always have like the first song they wanted to release to you about what was coming up. And, you know, in a pre-internet age, this is when you discovered what the next Disney film was going to be. And I remember looking at this, and apparently the big one was supposed to be Pocahontas. The A team were working on Pocahontas and the B team were working on Lion King.
Really?
And I kind of sat there and went, I was watching, I think it's Aladdin, this is the one that predates it. And I was watching it going, oh, it's a bunch of animals dancing around. Okay. And then you find out the voice is the kid from Home Improvement. And you're like, okay, there is no way this thing's going to work at all. And I went and saw it and have never been more wrong, I think, about my notion. Actually, I say this a few times, but it's one of those examples where I was totally wrong with what I had thought a film was going to be before going into it. And the layers of storytelling. I mean, it's Hamlet, isn't it? And I'm okay with the fact that it's Hamlet. Scar, this is the time when I think voice acting, Robin Williams was Robin Williams in Aladdin, but everybody else around him was just kind of doing standard Disney sort of fare. But like Jeremy Irons just oozes discomfort for the viewer.
So good.
So good. We have a little Nazi imagery and be prepared. There's some shock troops walking by him. And the music is sensational. Probably even discounting the Elton John trilogy, which everybody went nuts for, but it was Elton John's reemergence onto the stage. Pride Rock and the scene of that. You've got James Earl Jones as Mufasa with a death that, as a kid, I didn't see coming, and it would be traumatized. Even just some cutting-edge computer animation with the stampede in the gorge. And then just when you think you got the film figured out, we're bringing in Nathan Lane here at the start of the second act and going, what is this? And it was funny, it was was poignant. It was a little bit scary for a kid. It was all these things sort of wrapped into one. And then we bookend it with the same song and the same start. And we've reset so that now Simba has fully taken his father's place. And we sort of recreate the opening scene with our new equilibrium being established.
Circle of life.
The circle of life and the circle of our film. It is a perfectly made Disney film. And the only thing that I would go, the reason why it's three and not higher up is just that idea about, it's still a bit kiddie. I mean, it is a Disney film, so it's going to have sort of, you know, when you get to your cynical upper teens, I'm not sure if it would have had the same impact. I happen to hit it at the right point in my life to make that have the impact it did. And therefore still carry it thanks to the nostalgia and other things. It sort of survived my late teens, early 20s cynicism. And I carried it through as going, no, oh, it's good. I didn't feel that way about The Little Mermaid. I didn't feel that way about Beauty and the Beast. Aladdin and Lion King survive that sort of chasm, if you will. Yeah,
it's a great one. I had it at number, I shifted it with number five, number six. I had it like in that honorable mention area. So it's a great one. Aladdin is my favorite from the Disney animated films, but from the ones on the list, Lion King is great.
Yeah.
So my number three, if we had shifted orders of it, we might have gone James Cameron back to back to back.
Oh, okay.
Because with my third one, I went with Titanic also.
Oh, okay, excellent.
This is another one I saw in theaters. I saw it twice. And I think I mentioned this when you did your episode on Titanic, but I've always been a Titanic buff. I read A Night to Remember when I was a teen. I used to dig up books and information about the sinking. I think Liam was that way, right?
Liam loves his Titanic. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And it was something that I felt drawn to. So when James Cameron came and brought up this story with so much attention to detail, and you read or saw all those making of, when you see all the work he went through to recreate this boat and this sinking up to the china and the wood that is used in the stairs and whatnot, all those details, I mean, I felt it was made specifically for me. I like Jack and Rose's story. I admit there's some dialogue and acting issues, but it has charm and it has heart. And once we get past that and get into the story, the sinking of the ship and the tragedy of how and why so many people died, it's a film I always love watching, and it's a film that never fails to make me cry.
It's one I've been part of a few group viewings even in the last few years, and there's always elements that draw the tears. You think about the mother laying down in bed with her two children and just trying to settle them, or the old couple laying down one last time, or even the father who says to his children as they're going on the lifeboats, it's only goodbye for a little while.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad died when I was young. Okay. So I remember seeing these images and it hit me emotionally. Yeah. What do you do when you know these are your last moments, and how do you choose to spend them, and who do you spend them with, and how do you bring comfort to those who are going to be separated from in one capacity or another? Yeah. So just some highly emotive filmmaking from a guy who apparently is quite the curmudgeon on set.
Well, there you go. He knows how to pull our strings. You mentioned Terminator 2 also. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
So let's go with your number two.
My number two, I limited myself to one Marvel film. I wanted a Marvel film in there. I had about three on my shortlist, and I ended up having to choose, in a sense, it was a weird choice. I went with, it's either, do you choose Infinity War or do you choose Endgame? Was kind of where I went here. And I went, Endgame is one of the coolest corporate experiences I've ever been a part of in the cinema.
I agree.
When everybody starts coming back and you get on your left and you get Cap with the hammer and all these things, to look around and see people cheering like they were at a professional wrestling event, like they were cheering. It was the strangest, most incredible things. I'm not one to cheer at a screen. That's not, I will laugh, I will cry. But the idea about cheering was such a strange concept, but it was this weird corporate experience. But at the end, I chose not to go with that and choose what I think is the better film. I chose Infinity War.
Okay, yeah.
For my clip. And so I chose Infinity War because, I mean, A, it's Thanos' film. And I love a film where you take a villain and you make him the protagonist, and that's his movie. And everything being so well-structured, where you think there's several times where they've got him. And it's really interesting because he was on the sidelines for a long time, and the ease in, and you show up and you're on the ship with Thor and Loki, and Heimdall is dead. We don't even get to see that. That is held from us. He just drops to the ground and that's it. And we're like, so the movie even messes with my concept of what, as a viewer, I'm supposed to be entitled to get. And then you remove your key principles, and it builds up really towards two or three key scenes, but the one being the team up on whatever planet that is that he's on, where he throws a moon at Iron Man or whatever, but they've almost got the gauntlet off, and they pay it off so well. You know, before that scene even happens, you know that Star-Lord's going to be the one to let it down, and despite the fact that I know this, they still get me to buy in. They still get me to wish against wish and hope against hope and try and will him into doing the right thing, because it's the better story for it, and it's the more human story, and he's always been a character motivated by loss, and so that makes sense. And then we jump onto I can't believe I'm Wakanda for this final sort of real battle. And along everything else, you get Wanda having to destroy Vision and the heart that would take. Could you do that for the greater good? And then seeing all that undone, and you should have aimed for the head, because Thor comes out. It's the third act. Thor's got his super axe, and surely this is the moment. And you think he's won it, and they play with you there. He snaps and he just disappears and he's gone, and you watch each of these characters go, and of course you leave the last one and you pair the people up with the person they most, it'd be most painful to see them leave.
Yeah.
So of course you've got a Groot with Rocket, and then you've got you get Peter Parker and you get Iron Man, and the I don't feel so good and I don't want, and it just disappears in the dust, and then the film just ends and you get Thanos will return, and you're left with no comfort. And it's really hard to do this. Films try to do this a lot and fail. I'm thinking of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, where the whole thing's just a build-up for the second half. And I remember walking out of that one feeling so ripped off. I walked out of this thinking I'd seen one of the greatest films of my life, but yet it was a comic book movie, and going, how do those two things reconcile? And this emptiness and this, I think we walked out of the theater just in mourning, in collective mourning about, this is not how films are supposed to end. How can you dare do this? And it didn't feel like it was just a part one. It felt like there was a story that had been completed, and Thanos wins. He does exactly what he says he's going to do. He sits down on his porch and he watches the sunrise over his victory. And it felt earned.
Yeah.
It felt non-exploitive. But it crushed me every little bit inside. It took away, and it made me look through the eyes of Tony Stark as I watched Peter Parker, the most vulnerable of the Avengers, be taken. And you're going, how does he not own and wear that? And it was the perfect place to put the full stop. And one that, again, it's the opposite of the cheering corporately, because corporately we walked out in silence, like something had happened and we didn't want to bring it back to reality, because for just a few more moments, that's our collective shared experience. And the power of that silence, that theater was a quiet place.
I agree. It's a great moment that they kind of, they lose it a bit in Endgame. I mean, because you know what's going to happen. You know, they're going to bring everybody back. And I like both films. And I agree. I saw it in theaters also, both. And the collective experience of that final act in Endgame was just something else. But in terms of story, I preferred the bleakness of the first act. Yeah. I'm talking about Endgame. Oh. To see these people coping with grief, with the loss of the loved ones. And obviously, once they, I know we can reset this and we can fix this and we can bring everybody back. It kind of lost me a bit. But, you know, both were great experiences. And like you said, I agree about Infinity War. It was something else. It took me a while to get into the MCU. I got in late and kind of crammed most of the films like in a month or two to prepare for. I think it was for Infinity War, I think. And I think it was a great experience, both.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Endgame for me, it's three movies, isn't it? I mean, the first hour is how are people coping?
Yeah.
The second hour is a heist movie.
Yeah.
And then the third hour is smashing all your favorite toys together and just sort of having these moments. So it's... Liam and I went and watched that one. That was a midnight screening. But in order to guarantee tickets for the midnight screening, because demand was so high, they had a thing where if you bought tickets to see Infinity War, which they would air right before it, you could then keep your seat. So we sat there for about 6.5 hours of film watching straight. And I thought I think we were flagging a little bit in Endgame, but then once, you know, everybody starts coming back, the massive battle occurs. We were fully alert at that point. But that was one that is, it's a tall order to get through, but man, all the emotions, all, but you know what? Everybody goes nuts about Tony Stark, and no one even considers Black Widow and her sacrifice. We're told the movie tells us forget her. They're all standing around this monument for proof that Tony Stark has a heart. And anybody going to mention the tattoo? No, we're not. All right, there we go.
Yeah, I agree. Let's hope that they can bring some pathos to her at some point.
Hopefully.
So my number two, talking about cheering, this one goes right to that. This is another one I saw in theaters back in the day and still stand as one of my most memorable theater-going experiences. And I went with Return of the King. I couldn't really have any film of the trilogy here. Like I said, I actually prefer Fellowship if you ask me to choose one of them. But this is the one that was on the list. And to me, it represents the realization of this project that might seem like a small thing to some right now because of how we are accustomed to see big blockbusters be. But this is something that nobody thought would succeed. This is something that it was an epic project of three movies filmed back to back to back, assigned to a director that made Bad Taste and Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead of all films with a cast of mostly unknowns, a massive budget, backed up by two studios, which was something unheard of at that point. And to have it succeed the way it succeeded, I mean, Peter Jackson and everybody involved turned their stories into that of the Hobbits, as far as underdogs that succeed despite unsurmountable odds. Yeah. And to do it in such a spectacular way, with a great story, great characters, thrilling battles. The moment here that will forever be stuck in my mind is when Eowyn finally faces the Nazgul. And if you've seen the film, you know that moment. I am no man. The whole theater was about to fall. You can say it was maybe cliche, it was forced, whatever. People were going crazy at that moment. People were hollering, shouting, clapping, cheering. I was hollering, shouting, clapping, cheering. It was a great moment. And like I said, one of my favorite theater going experiences. Nobody cared about who was cheering because everybody was into it. And it was what blockbuster should be. It was exactly what I wanted from that film.
Yeah, I've always felt about, I agree with you, Fellowship, I think, is a better film. But like you said, not on the list. Sean Astin, I always felt he was robbed of at least an Academy Award nomination for
definitely.
I remember walking out of there and he was the guy. A lot of people were making noise for Andy Serkis, who was great and the idea about motion capturing and what you can do with such a role. But I thought Sean Astin was incredible throughout that and deserved better.
I agree.
I'm not the world's I remember I saw this live in the cinema. I saw it with a group of friends. I remember drinking far too much soda and having to use the toilet and then going, how many endings is this film going to have?
Yes.
Because Jackson loved to fade to black and then making you think it's over and we've got more down the line.
He pushes it with that last act, yeah.
Yeah, a beautiful conclusion to a very, very, very well-told story. I'm curious, were you a fan of the source material going in? So had you read the books?
No, I had never read the book. It's not something that we're used to see here in Puerto Rico. I really didn't know much about it when the films were made.
Okay. It's now we think it's commonplace, but when you think about how do they make the Hobbit so short, that was a big deal. Like, we're not going to tell you how they make the Hobbit so short. We'll see with their feet, and how do you do this, and how do you do that? And now we would look at it and go, well, of course you can do all those things. But that was the first time we'd seen a lot of these sort of techniques to that point. And also maybe the birth of one of those really CG, I mean, we had some natural landscapes being shot in New Zealand, but also a fair amount of green screen to make things occur. And I think that's become more of a norm, and it didn't look out of place. It was pulled off seamlessly. And it was one of those things where, I mean, obviously it won like all the Oscars. It was one of those things where I think they didn't reward Fellowship or Two Towers as much as they should have with the justification, basically.
So the last one.
Or just to give it all to Return of the King. Yeah.
Yeah.
But really well done.
Okay. Let's go with your last one, with your number one.
My last one, maybe a bit cynical of a choice. See, middle films are great because middle films, you don't have to pay everything off and you can leave them in disarray. And we just talked about Infinity War. I could be just as easily talking about Empire Strikes Back, but I'm not. I'm going, when a film reaches the cultural zeitgeist and everybody is focused on something, and the amount of buzz for Christopher Nolan's follow-up to Batman Begins, and then you have a tragic passing of Heath Ledger, but then gives us almost a urban legend element to it. And, you know, is this the role that pushed him over the edge? Well, he was halfway through shooting Dr. Parnassus, but still, it became sort of the storyline of this disturbed character and figure. And just just like Infinity War is Thanos' story, you've got, which is weird, I hadn't thought of this when I was putting my list together, but you've got a film that's very much the Joker story, more of into this Batman. So he was heavily featured in a lot of the merchandising and a lot of the marketing. The opening shot is the Joker with that mask off, and you don't know it's him yet, but we give him the soft open, if you will, and we establish who he is, and he is note perfect. Yes,
definitely.
It's complicated, and the movie doesn't give you answers. You want, it's really funny, I just watched Citizen Kane last night. You want answers from the Joker, and we're not going to give you any answers about who he is or what he is. We just know he is Batman's counterpoint in this weird codependent kind of relationship. And the score by Hans Zimmer is nothing short of inspired, and everything just feels chaotic. The only issue being a side plot to Hong Kong that's completely unnecessary, but I understand why you do it to reach a... It was the first time I actually saw a film cater to that Chinese audience as a way to try and make sure we get that marketplace as it emerges. But the tone of it is... The Joker is equally haunting, frightening, humorous, but always cool. And it is kind of that era where 2008 is kind of the era where anti-heroes are everywhere. Dexter is a big deal on television. And, you know, telling the story of the corrupt individual rather than the heroic individual has become the thing. And there's nothing greater of it encapsulates it than The Dark Knight and Heath Ledger's Joker. And what if he hadn't had tragedy befall him? What does the third act of that trilogy look like then, when you don't have to pivot to Bane-centric? And maybe there's more of a collaborative thing on that side. But even, and I don't want to sleep on Aaron Eckhart, who I think everybody always sleeps on in every movie he's in as Two-Face, the guy was Oscar-worthy as well, at least of a nomination. I'm glad he didn't, because I think it might have potentially split the vote. An absolute, it's to the point where Christian Bale's like the third or fourth best thing in the film. And that's saying something when your title character, who's not bad in this by any means, but you know, the price of poker has gone up, so to speak. And you left with this feeling of awe. So not like that quietness, but just, this is the coolest film I've ever seen. Is kind of how, and Gary Oldman's great. I mean, I can just keep going on about people who steal the show in this. Morgan Freeman is sublime in it. So you take an acting masterclass collaboratively by a bunch of individuals, and then you wrap a superhero story about it, where the key question is, what is human nature? Are we designed to act in our best interest, or are we designed to be compassionate? Is man good or is man evil? And we take the Joker and Batman and make them the two sort of champions of those two theories, chaos versus order. And it's brilliant. I just love it. So that is me. My number one is The Dark Knight.
Great. I knew it was going to be that one. I saw it coming. No, but I like the film a lot. I saw it in theaters also, and I'm a huge fan of Heath Ledger in that performance. I love that contrast of both characters, which is why I went with the quote that I went, because I love that. I love that line. I love the way he delivers it, and it's great. I have slightly major issues with the last act.
Okay.
I think the last act is too rushed. It feels messy. Aaron Eckhart deserved better.
Yeah.
And I think he even deserved the third film. But it's a great film. I agree. So my number one, the last one, I saw this in theaters back in the day also, and it was such a great experience. I went with Jurassic Park. I think I said this to you when you did your episode on the film back then, but that moment when Grant and Ellie finally see the dinosaurs, and you know, Grant pulling off his glasses, that was magical to see on the screen. But aside from the technical and visual marvel, the film is a hell of a fun ride. Thrilling, funny, fast-paced. The set pieces are unique. You know, the T-Rex scene. You have the chase of the T-Rex when it's chasing the Jeep. That scene was great. Characters have charisma by truckloads. Everybody in the theater was so into the film. When the raptors attack Ellie in the shed, that moment, I jumped at that moment. That was a fantastic moment. Once again, talking about blockbusters, it's everything you could ask from a blockbuster. I really, really, really love that film. I think it's one of the most entertaining films ever.
Film was a cultural event, without a question. It was everywhere. Yeah. In Toronto, our basketball team is called the Raptors because they came out just after after Jurassic Park. I mean, that's the impact that had over anything to do with Toronto or with Canada. We went with what's the cool thing right now? Dinosaurs. And we ran with it. It's weird. It's one I didn't see until several years later. I think that's why I didn't make my list. I somehow missed that. Occasionally when I was a teenager, I could turn into what's everybody into? Well, I'm going to be the contrarian and just not go see it. I don't know what it was that caused the delay. And then when I finally did see it, I really appreciated it. But I think I'd heard from people so much how brilliant the film was. I don't know how you could possibly, the best you can hope for is to meet the hype rather than, you know.
Yeah.
So it was impossible for me to have my socks blown off because the bar had been raised so high. And it's just one I didn't see in the cinema. And I think it's that idea about, you know, that corporate viewership. I would love now, years later, to go see Jurassic Park in the theater on the big screen. What would that look like with the sound all around me and the dinosaur looking like it's several stories above me? What is the impact of that compared to when I was probably watching for the first time on a little 24-inch TV at my parents' house? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely not the same. I mean, it loses a bit.
But I think it speaks to, it seems to be me. I love dialogue. I love acting. And I think most of my things you can see, I was more or less talking about the acting performances, even with things of spectacle. Our Titanic reviews were actually quite different. I was really kind of leaning towards story and acting performances. And you've got some spectacle, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the way that, I guess, visually, I mean, Kevin Smith, the director, said he saw Jurassic Park. He saw the dinosaur. He started to cry because he said there's never anything that's going to be a barrier for me as a filmmaker ever again. And yet I'm still dialogue. Maybe it's the English teacher in me. I don't know. But I still really love and appreciate these concepts. But, you know, I went with character. It's really interesting. I went with character-based things for my two-in-one specifically. And you're sort of tying on those key visual moments, which I know if Liam was here, that's his wheelhouse entirely. So,
yeah.
And again, it speaks to the crux of what's wonderful about film. You look at it and you can love, you can even love the same film, but we can come up for two totally different reasons why you love that film.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I ended up, which is what I mentioned a while ago, I ended up going with what I could possibly classify as some of my best theater going experiences, which all of those apply for different reasons and different moments in my life. Terminator 2, Jurassic Park, Lord of the Rings, all of those are moments and were experiences that I cherish to be in the theater and experiencing them. Speaking of blockbusters, well.
Such scope in your, like, I think about these shots in all three of those movies. I'm thinking Jurassic Park, I'm thinking Titanic, I'm thinking Lord of the Rings, and just like these giant wide shots of just spectacle in front of you.
Yeah.
And as a view, that's why you go to the movies, isn't it? To see spectacle.
Yeah.
That's what blockbusters are. So a very deserving top three.
So as usual, I went and asked on Twitter for people to share their favorite blockbusters. And this is what I got. So I'm going to share with you. Nostalgia Cast at DW Lundberg. He said, just set the standard, man. Every movie that came after it has been chasing the same box office drug. And dollar signs have taken up permanent residence in every studio executive's eyes because of it. We talk about just so we know it's right. Ken at Interken said, I will seize upon any chance to kick down the door and evangelize through a bullhorn about Superman, the 1978 movie starring Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder. It's my favorite movie of all time, and I only appreciate it more now that superhero movies are a dime a dozen. End quote.
It's definitely a good shout if it wasn't for sort of the financial sort of restrictions we've put in place.
Yeah.
Superman is huge. It wouldn't have made my list, but I can totally understand that sort of logic.
Yeah, I was researching when I saw his tweet. It set many records for best opening day, best weekend, best weekly, single day gross. It went on to earn $300 million, and it was the highest grossing film of 1978 in North America. So
in my head, I can still see that kid playing. I don't know if it's number one or number two. I think it's one, where the kid's playing with like the fence.
Yeah.
The gate at Niagara Falls and falls off of it. I remember that so well.
I think it's the second one.
Is that the second one? Oh, yeah, man. Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, love me some Superman. Love me the original, the first two. The third one scarred my sister.
No,
when the woman takes her face off, scarred my sister.
I don't remember the third one. I remember not liking it that much because it kind of leaned too much on comedy. They had Richard Pryor.
Is that
Pryor
Richard Pryor?
And,
yeah.
Yes. But the first two are great. I haven't seen the second one in a good while, but I revisited the first one last year.
Okay.
And I had a lot of fun with it. I thought it was great.
That's a good shout. I might go back. I'll look at that sometime soon.
So Jake Lindberg at Spade Archer Jake, he said, Empire Strikes Back, just a classic, enjoyable blockbuster emulating the classical Hollywood style. Personal favorite, though Empire aside, is Moonraker. Just love that nutty Star Wars ripoff.
Yeah, that was, what if we did James Bond and Star Wars together?
I haven't seen the Roger Moore ones since I was a kid, so.
I used to say Roger Moore was my favorite Bond. I don't know what I was thinking. I think I was just trying to be contrarian.
I've been getting into the franchise for the last couple of years, and I've seen almost all of the Connery ones. I saw the Lazenby one, and I'm about to dive into the Roger Moore ones, which I only remember like one or two.
Okay.
But at least I walk in with the expectation because I know what everybody says about Roger Moore now. So
yeah. He's smooth. He's a smooth Bond. I'll give him that. He's not the fisticuffs Bond that Connery was. So, yeah, I'll give him that, but God bless him.
So, David Rawson at Piecing Pod, host of the Piecing It Together podcast, he said, Jurassic Park is the best, but Independence Day might be my favorite, which you mentioned earlier in the episode.
Yeah, that was huge. Yeah. That was everywhere. It's probably the best and the worst of 1990s blockbuster filmmaking. But who would have thought Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum? Those are the two guys I'm going to hang my hat on. And it's great. Randy Quaid, hello, boys. I'm back. It's good fun. It's a fun film. I don't know if it's a good film. Yeah. It's a fun film.
No, yeah, I agree. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I remember what I remember distinctively about Independence Day is the teaser. I remember that I was in the movies with my best friends, and they played this teaser, the one where people are on the street, and you see that everything blowing up. That was it. And we were sold. We were hooked on it. It was so great. We have to see this. I didn't like the film that much. But
the box art. I remember it wasn't even any of the stars. Nothing. Nothing star.
No.
It was the shot of the White House and the blowing beam up. Coming down into it. Yeah. Like that was your one sheet. That was, it's amazing.
Yeah. This is what you're going to get. You're going to get explosions and so Alex, art by Alex J, he said, Jurassic Park with its storylines, making of documentaries, and McDonald's tie-ins introduced me to the world of big tent summer blockbusters. The movie is top tier, but you couldn't seem to escape it. Same with Batman 89 a few years
earlier. That's what we didn't talk about, really, but the idea of blockbusters tend to sort of bleed outside of a cinema and sort of capture tie-ins with either soft drink companies or restaurants. Like Dick Tracy was everywhere the one year. Like, oh my.
Yeah.
That was not didn't hit, but you know, these films that sort of permeate into youth culture, whatever that means. So McDonald's, Coke, Pepsi, things of that nature.
Yeah. Sylvie at Sly underscore Witch, she said, Titanic. People love to hate it, but I think it's epic storytelling at its finest. One could also argue that it was the last true blockbuster, a ridiculously ambitious passion project that no one thought would earn its budget back rather than something created to be a tentpole. And you know, what I love, this is me now, but what I love about Titanic in terms of its box office run is that it didn't have an impressive first weekend, at least not by today's standards. I mean, it made like 20, 28 million or 20 something, oh, really? Which is, but it had staying power. The film had a plus 24% increase in its second weekend. It made more in its second weekend than it made in the first weekend. And it ended up staying at first place from December to March. That's amazing.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, one year later, it was still in theaters.
I made myself, listening to the concept of how it might be the last true blockbuster, I'm looking at my list, and so much of my stuff is 80s and 90s, one that I made for myself here. The only exception I have is I do have one film from 2000 onward that I considered to be kind of original, and that was Gladiator.
Okay.
That's the only ever one that I kind of had that was like, you know, blockbuster-ish, original, nothing done since. But no, for the most part, I think your contributor there is bang on. Yeah. You know, epic storytelling doesn't happen anymore. We just go for the safe bet.
So next one, Spooky Twinkle Toes at Loser at L-E-W-Z-R is one of my regulars. He said, Endgame! With a lot of A.
Okay.
Endgame had a reported budget of around $400 billion, which is crazy, but it ended up making double that in US and Canada. And double that worldwide.
Yeah.
So definitely.
Yeah, it's I guess it's easier to know when you got 22 or 21 films before it's setting you up for it. But yeah, I mean, that's an ambitious budget, but obviously paid off in spades.
And the last one, Tom at Death Heaven, he said, Ben-Hur. While Casablanca shall always be my favorite film, I maintain that Ben-Hur from 1959 may well be the most perfect movie ever created. It defines the term epic. It is grand in scope, story, score, and performance. And this is me. Ben-Hur had a budget of $15 million. When released, it earned double that in North America alone, and it was number one at the box office for 6 months. It was also the highest grossing film of 1959. Tom's been trying for me to watch Ben-Hur, and it's not that I don't want to watch it. It's just I'm trying to see when I can squeeze it in. It's a big movie.
Yeah.
It's not streaming free on any platform, so I have to wait till the right moment that I can pay for it and watch it. But he's a big fan, and he's been trying it. I've been saying to him, you know, okay, I'm going to watch it. Okay, just give me some time. So I have to get to it.
My parents have this in VHS form on their... We were a movie-watching family, so I can see exactly where it is. Is that Charlton Heston?
Yes.
Ben-Hur? Yeah, it's Chariots and all that. It's very gladiator-esque. Yeah, but did you say the budget was 15-15 or 50-50? 15-15. Okay. Yeah, I guess it speaks to just the economics of film. I know $15 million at the time is a massive budget, but I guess it still speaks to kind of where we went to. But as far as big epic films go, I mean, I can't argue against it at all. It's, again, scope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's it, Ian. What are your plans for the future? What do you and the gang have in store for best film ever?
Oh, geez. When is this dropping? Do we know?
Probably middle of the month, 15.
Okay. So, I mean, we're sort of, again, just sort of plowing through whatever's next on the agenda. We do have a lot of summer blockbusters, and then we actually have a lot of choices by the panel, which doesn't usually happen that frequently. They've been very patient in waiting for kind of their turn to pick some films. I have to make good on a bet I made about we couldn't crack a certain listenership number by our first anniversary, which we did. So I know we've got Grease coming up at some point in the very near future. So it's not the one that I want, but I will be using one of my picks on Grease as I pay up for the bet we made. Outside of that, we got a round table on Tom Cruise, which is talk about blockbusters. I mean, Tom Cruise knows himself a blockbuster movie, maybe the most bankable movie star maybe in history as far as those sorts of films, and a guy who realized very early, get it on the production side because that's where the real money's made. So looking forward to that. We've had a great number of contributions from our listenership already of their lists. I'm looking forward to hearing what the panel thinks. I think George has seen like 3 Tom Cruise films. I'm like, I don't know how that's even possible. I've seen like 25, but such is. And outside of that, we're just sort of chasing that rainbow. I mean, obviously the Olympics are coming up. I think we're doing a roundtable on some best sports movies as well. I'm looking forward to doing that. Talk about a broad spectrum there. But outside of that, just going, my favorite part of every episode is going, and here's what we're watching next week. And it's just that sort of, and you know, people do comment occasionally about the camaraderie it sounds like we have on the pod. And it's because most of the time we're actually, now that the COVID pandemic starting to, the restrictions in the UK are starting to be taken away and we can congregate in people's homes a bit more frequently, is we do tend to watch them as a corporate group as well in the same physical space and then go record the pod right afterwards. And we break bread, we have food, we sort of have that environment. I think it lends itself well to the recording process. And so the favorite part is, what are we watching next week? And I keep it such a secret because I love seeing the reactions. Or when I'm in the dark, I love having that honest reaction to what are we watching next week. So best place for people to get a hold of that conversation, just over at the Twitter, at Best Film Ever Pod. Yeah, we have Instagram, same address, and Facebook, same address. But the main conversation does seem to take place for us anyway on the Twitter. So it's a great place for anybody out there who might want to get involved in the dialogue. Join the fledgling fandom over at Best Film Ever Pod.
Yes. That's great. Definitely recommend it. So for everybody out there, check out Ian and the gang at Best Film Ever. I guarantee that you're going to have fun with it. So thank you for being here. It was great talking with you. I wish you and everybody at Best Film Ever the best. Take care.
Hey, thanks so much. We're huge fans of yours and wish you also nothing but the best as we both try and direct our ships forward in the coming future.
Thank you. Take care. And that was it for our Blockbuster Loot. Once again, I want to thank Ian for accepting the invitation and for the great chat. Had a great time with him, so remember to check out Best Film Ever Podcast, one of the best film podcasts out there right now. Listen, follow, and share their work. As for me, you know you can find me at TeefCGT and the podcast at TMML2021. Also, rarely use it, but look for me on Instagram, and if you want to know what I'm watching, follow me on Letterboxd as Teef12. Remember to follow us and share the link so more people can join us in the loot. Have a great day, everybody, and keep looting.
Farewell, my brave friends. My work is now finished. Here at last, on the shores of the sea, comes the end. Not say, do not weep. Not all tears are an evil. It is time, Frodo.
What does he mean? We set out to save the Shire, Sam. And it has been saved. But not for me. You don't mean that. You can't leave.